Greetings, listeners. Welcome to Whiskey and International Relations Theory, the podcast which is pretty much what it sounds like. Patrick Jackson and Dan Nexon, that's me, drink some whiskey and shoot the shit about a work of international theory. This is the third episode. It contains part one of our discussion of Cynthia Enloe's classic work of feminist international relations, Bananas, Beaches, and Bases. That's pretty much it. But I should, well, actually, no, because I should warn you that this episode is even longer than the first one. So anyway, without further ado, on to the episode. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Dan.
So how are you enjoying your basement?
Well, it is virus-free, as far as I can tell. Streaming still works. There's a lot of games. You know, if you have to be quarantined, it's not a bad place to be quarantined.
You know, it's funny because we recorded the first episode in your basement together.
Yes.
And now, to be clear, we are not together. We are both coming. We are coming to you from our respective basements. I actually have my distance learning education virus bunker, which I have set up over the last few days as I bring things into my office, complete with plenty of recording equipment, which will hopefully improve the quality of the podcast. And because we're not together, that means, unfortunately, that I'll just be honest about this. I will be drinking whiskey, but it will not be today's whiskey selection because I don't have it. So what are we talking about today, Patrick?
I was going to say that's entirely too bad because the whiskey that I have for today is absolutely perfect for the book that talking about. So I doubt I'm going to drink the entire bottle today. We'll see how long the conversation goes. But the book we're going to be talking about today is Cynthia Enloe's Bananas, Beaches, and Bases, which was originally published in 1989 and was released in a thoroughly revised and expanded edition in 2014. So the whiskey that I have chosen to go along with this is a 10-year-old Benriach peated whiskey. And part of the reason for doing that is because the chief distiller of the Benriach distillery and the family of companies that they own is Rachel Berry, who is one of the most prominent female blenders and distillers in the Scottish whiskey industry. So I thought that was appropriate for a key work of feminist IR. But also, the name of this particular whiskey is Curiositas. And given that Cynthia Enloe is the person who, among her other many accomplishments, coined the term feminist curiosity, I thought a whiskey called Curiositas was absolutely appropriate for today's selection.
All right, well, cheers.
Cheers. Yum.
Now, one benefit or perhaps drawback of doing the podcast this way is that neither of us have to drive home afterwards. So we'll see how that works in terms of whether more alcohol gets the conversation flowing or whether it just makes us stupid.
Time will tell.
All right. So we are reading the second edition today,
yes,
not the first edition. And it's very clearly the second edition because it has references to the internet and social media and developments that long come after the book. But can you talk a little bit about who Cynthia Enloe is still alive? So it feels a little bit weird to be talking about her this way. But could you talk about a little bit about who she is and what the significance of this book is?
Certainly. Well, Cynthia Enloe, born 1938, is a tremendously important path-breaking feminist researcher in the field of political science and international relations in particular. She actually earned her PhD in 1967 at Berkeley. She was the first ever female head TA for Aaron Wildavsky, who was at that point just a junior up-and-coming person. She has an award named after her in the International Feminist Journal of Politics. The Cynthia Enloe Award is in honor of Cynthia Enloe's pioneering feminist research into international politics and political economy and her considerable contribution to building a more inclusive feminist scholarly community. I think it's fair to say that she is something of a legend in the world of feminist IR and in the world of IR generally. If you've ever been fortunate enough to see her speak, she has an amazingly compelling style. She's one of these people who likes to walk around the podium and walk through the crowd while she's talking. So she's an amazingly gifted speaker. She has written 15 books, according to her official biography, and has been consistently concerned with questions not just of gender, but of with the introduction of a feminist consciousness into the way that we think about international politics. And her term for this, as we'll talk about in the book, is feminist curiosity, is kind of the thing that she keeps coming back to. This is also, to move this to a slightly more autobiographical note for a second, I read the first edition of this book in the very first international relations class that I ever took as an undergraduate student. So 1991, fall semester, Michael G. Schechter's Introduction to International Relations course at Michigan State University. And this book was in the second half of the semester, and it was a book that I found challenging and frustrating at the same time. And it was one of the first books that I read that showed that there was a different way of thinking about international relations that wasn't just wrapped up with, like, the great politics of the great powers, that there was other things you could do in international studies. So it was a tremendously important book, just kind of in terms of my own personal theoretical formation. And it wasn't until many, many years later that I realized how out in front Professor Schechter was assigning this book a year after it had been published in a mainstream Introduction to International Relations course. So this is not something that was on the syllabus at Columbia, shall we say, when we were there as graduate students.
Nor was it on the syllabus at Harvard, and I have actually never read this book before. You know, I've read, I'm one of those academics, I would say I've read excerpts, which means that I've probably gone to my copy occasionally to pull out a quotation that would seem good, but I've never read it all the way through before the last few weeks. So I'm really coming at this new.
Which is absolutely fascinating. It's going to be neat to see how we proceed through this. Unfortunately, because of our friend, the novel coronavirus, I don't have my copy from 1991, so I can't look at my own marginalia, and so I'm not even going to try to reconstruct what I thought of the book back then. I just have the notes I've made on it, reading it now. And I'd never read the second edition before, so I do not have any sense of what's new and what's not, except obviously things with dates on them after 1989 or in the second edition and not the first.
I will say before we start, you know, this is a little awkward. We're two male academics. Neither of us are known for doing feminist work. Patrick has done some critical work, but neither of us, I think, would be seen as particularly critical in our orientations. And so this is a little bit of a risk, because if, you know, this gets a wide enough listenership among our friends who do know what they're talking about, we might get some hate mail.
It's possible, but at the same time, I think it's incumbent on any serious scholar to look at works that take fundamentally different orientations to the kind of things that we are interested in. The way that Enloe wants us to do international relations is very different, and I think that's well worth considering. And by choosing something that is an acknowledged landmark in feminist IR, and I would argue IR in general, not just feminist IR, I think we are doing our scholarly due diligence, shall we say.
All right, well, let's get started. So the first chapter is called Gender Makes the World Go Round, and it is where Enloe lays out a series of propositions about how we should do feminist scholarship and feminist study and feminist research into international politics. Any basic reactions to this chapter? There's a lot going on in it, and it prefigures, of course, what happens later in the book.
Yes, most definitely. I think the interesting thing here is that Enloe wants to persistently ask a couple of different questions, which she thinks goes along with exercising a feminist curiosity. One of them is the question, where are the women? And then there's the question, where are masculine and feminine dichotomies? In particular, where is fragile masculinity, and how do these dichotomies work to shore up that fragile sense of masculinity? And then that, I think, opens out into a third version of this, which is where are gendered practices generally within international politics? So you end up with a kind of ever-expanding sense of what would fit under a feminist curiosity. And so this chapter is kind of a tour of the landscape, if you will. And I think the two brief case studies at the end are really good illustrations of the kind of work that she wants us to engage in, which then she will delve into in future chapters.
Yeah, two things really struck me about this chapter. The first is that she makes a really strong case, and a case that I assume when this book first came out was fairly novel, and that's why it's so important, which is that when you look at international politics and you ask the question, where are the women, and you look for women, you're not necessarily going to find that international politics is the same thing that we think it is when we look at it through a non-feminist lens. That is a traditional lens of states interacting with one another or great leaders, all of whom are usually men until very recently, or the kinds of questions, the kinds of things that you study in international political economy, the flows of trade at very kind of abstract levels, or how multinational firms organize their production. Those sorts of things are they're all implicated, and they're all going to ultimately be implicated in very profound ways once you start looking for the women. But where you look is not traditional. So you look at the wives of diplomats. You look at the emergence of female diplomats as a thing. You look at sex tourism and the tourist industry more broadly. You look at bases and the political economy of gendered labor that develops around bases. And all these things suddenly become objects of inquiry in international relations. And they weren't really objects of inquiry for most people beforehand. I think even now they're still not necessarily legitimate objects of inquiry for most of what happens in the field. Or they might be legitimate, but it's not what most of us do.
Agreed. And I think right at the very beginning on page 3, she points this out. As we will discover, a disco can become an arena for international politics. So can someone else's kitchen or your own closet. One of the things that struck me the most in reading this book this time is the way that she's very comfortable with the second person, with addressing the reader directly in ways that the authorial voice of, say, Walt that we were reading last time, or many of the other quote-unquote mainstream works in the field, write from not having a perspective, not acknowledging a perspective, whereas Enloe is very clearly saying, no, there's a conversation here. I am addressing you, the reader. So that was something that sort of was immediately striking to me, but also the way that she's very, very willing, and in fact urges us to be willing, to look at these sorts of other arenas. So I think of work in popular culture and popular culture in international politics, which isn't exactly what Enloe's writing about, but clearly this opens up space for that kind of work as well. So looking outside of the traditional corridors of power and formal negotiations among registered diplomats and those kinds of things. And what's also interesting, there's one other point that I had about this, though, which is that there's a doubleness, I think, to the question that she asks of where the women are. On the one hand, there's a way that she argues that looking, asking the question, where are the women, are going to help us understand the operations of the power system better. So looking at, there's a sort of epistemic privilege, you might say, to looking where the women are and seeing how gendered relations are being produced and held in place. But there's more to a feminist curiosity than just that. There seems to be more than just an explanatory benefit to this. There's also kind of a critical political benefit to this. So asking where the women are also helps to foreground the stories that these women have, the experiences of those that are marginalized by the system. So I think that doubleness, at least in my reading, runs through the entire book, and she goes back and forth between these registers in ways that I think we can tease out a little bit in some of the later chapters. But right at the very beginning, she's kind of signaling that doubleness.
I would bet that we both marked up heavily the same passage, which is part of a paragraph on page 3, where she says, making feminist sense of international politics requires that you exercise genuine curiosity about each of these women's lives, these women she's been talking about, and the lives of women you have yet to think about. And that curiosity will have to fuel energetic detective work, careful digging into the complex experiences and ideas of domestic workers, hotel chambermaids, women's rights activists, women diplomats, women married to diplomats, women who are the mistresses of male elites, women sewing machine operators, women who have become sex workers, women soldiers, women forced to become refugees, and women working on agribusiness plantations. This is a very specific claim about what it means to do feminist scholarship. And I think we probably ought to unpack that, to use that cliched term, a little bit more. Because this implies close ethnography, right? It enclose, it entails a kind of a way of doing international politics which is necessarily empathetic, right? It was necessarily about having empathy and understanding of the lived experiences of others. It may not be ethnographic in the sense that, you know, it may not be like going out into the field and meeting people, but it may entail reading autobiography, right? Or it may entail interviewing people rather than, as I said, sort of hanging out in the UN for a year around women diplomats. But it definitely requires the reconstruction of live experience. And that's something that I think you might have something to say about. Is that necessary for feminist scholarship? What does it imply if we go down that route? Is it necessarily, is that exclusively feminist? These are all kind of, I think, interesting questions that arise.
I agree. And I think that the doubleness that I was pointing to before is precisely about this. And one might tentatively say that we're talking here about the difference between a feminist curiosity as a theoretical point and a feminist curiosity as a methodological point. So feminist curiosity as a theoretical point would say something like, we don't really understand what's going on in world politics unless we pay attention to these marginalized voices, and particularly to marginalized women, because if we can see the spaces where power is being exercised so as to hold those women in a subordinate position. And parenthetically, this also struck me very strongly as reminiscent of W.E.B. Du Bois's argument in Souls of Black Folk about the double consciousness and the privilege, epistemic privilege, of being able to see things from the point of view of the marginalized, because you can see and understand the workings of power better if you put your eyes at that sort of marginal space. So in that sense, I think there's a very important kind of claim there. There's another claim here, though, which is this claim about lived experience, and the claim about the individual perceptions that the particular subjects, particularly the marginalized female subjects, have in here. And I'm not 100% sure that these two things necessarily have to go together in some absolute sense. It's clear that for Enloe they do go together. That to engage in feminist curiosity and studying these kinds of marginal spaces also means reconstructing that set of lived experiences. So if we're looking at, say, page 35, to do this requires remapping the boundaries of the international and the political. It requires seeing how one's own family dynamics, consumer behaviors, travel choices, relationships with others, and ways of thinking about the world actually help shape that world. We are not just acted upon, we are actors. That claim, to me, is somewhat ambiguous between those two different registers. Is that a claim saying, in order to understand the existing boundaries, we have to take seriously the actions of people on the margins? Or is that a claim saying, we need to highlight the stories of those on the margins because doing so is a positive good, is a contribution to a better way of thinking about the world, kind of a almost in a moral register? And I think that's a really important doubleness, or I don't know, I don't even want to say tension, but there are these couple of different agendas that are going on here throughout the book. And I think it's how they're woven together is one of the things that makes it such a fascinating text.
So I missed some of what you said because my daughter came down the stairs and I was kind of wondering what was going on.
Sometimes that happens, you know, that's the
super embarrassing, but I think you're right. Now, as much as I heard what you had to say, I think you're definitely, I'm sure you're right.
Well, actually, can I make one more point about
sure,
that, just sort
yeah.
of extending that point? If you look at page 36, there's a place where, I mean, my note, and this, I'll explain this allusion to people who are not Dan in a second, that my note here says the hacking ladder. Page 36, if we can expose their dependence on feminizing women, we can show that this world is also dependent on artificial notions of masculinity. And as a result, this seemingly overwhelming world system may begin to look more fragile and open to radical change than we have been led to imagine. Now, I refer to this as the hacking ladder. This is the three points of social construction in Ian Hacking's marvelous book, The Social Construction of What, where Hacking points out that, like, stage one is things don't have to be the way they are. They're not the way they are by natural necessity. They're the way they are because they've been constructed. And then there's step two and step three. Step two is because they are constructed, they can be changed. And because the third step is because they can be changed and they have been constructed, they should be reconstructed in a different kind of direction. Hacking's claim is that one doesn't actually have to commit to all three of those, but some people do and some people don't. I think it's clear to me that Enlow commits to all three of those propositions. So,
yeah, I mean, at the risk of potentially repeating what you said when I got distracted, I think it's also really important to note that the argument of the book is a denaturalization exercise, right? That it is an attempt breaking down categories that we assume to be given, or we assume to be given historically inevitable, biologically inevitable, and showing that they've been socially constructed, right? Which is a very kind of essential element of almost all feminisms. And so she does, there is a thread where she pays consistent attention to the importance of denaturalization and how what she's talking about is a denaturalizing move. And I think that's going to be important for us as we move on. Anything else about this chapter?
No, I think we've hit most of the major points of this chapter. A lot of what she does, especially in those two cases that she studies at the end, is tries to preemptively answer the question, or preemptively answer the objection, perhaps, from more mainstream scholars who would say, well, gender isn't really important to world politics. So she gives these two case studies, and I think they're an interesting choice, because her first case study is about the abolition of slavery, and her argument there is that we don't actually understand how slavery was abolished unless we understand the role that women activists played in bringing about that change. So it's a kind of interesting, it's an interesting set of observations about something that people who are not feminists would perhaps be interested in explaining and saying, no, you need gender and you need women in order to understand this outcome that is of interest to you. But then her second case study isn't so much about that. Her second case study is saying, here are the ways that the phrase gender-based violence was introduced into the arms trade treaty. It's not about how the arms trade treaty was negotiated or why it was passed. It's about how the concerted political action of feminist activists changed something in the treaty. So we've got these two different kinds of things going on. It's almost like the first case study is, okay, for all of you who don't think that gender is important, let me tell you why gender is important to things that you're already interested in. And then the second one is to say, and there are ways in which we have to take the actions of women activists seriously in order to understand certain things. So it's got this interesting strategy of kind of hitting both sides of that at the same time. So if you are skeptical about one of them, then you'll end up saying, oh, the other one, well, this is a reason why we should engage in this feminist curiosity.
Yeah, there are actually two things when you were talking about that it reminded me. What you were talking about reminded me of something that I wanted to say, which is that, and again, something that we may come back to later. The first is that what I find, again, really striking about the first chapter, and it's something that will continue throughout the entire book, is how powerfully she makes a case for the idea that studying the international is a really broad object of inquiry. And so it does extend, you know, from your closet, right, the clothes that are made into it, into all sorts of domains that we normally don't think of as international. That raises a kind of question, though, which is, what is the domain of international politics? Is everything international politics? And I think her answer at the end of the book is actually kind of yes. You know, maybe that's something we do or don't want to accept. The second thing here is that there is a kind of tension. It's not a tension. I think actually she's well aware of it and does a fairly good job of dealing with it. But so if part of what you're doing is saying the international is everywhere and encompasses a lot of sets of power relations that we don't normally think of as international politics, both because those power relations are generated by international dynamics, but also are generative of international dynamics, she also has to, of course, reclaim women's agency, Right. So she has to show that women are actors and that agency often operates in arenas that we're not used to looking for it. Right, which makes her work very consistent with the 90s move, for example, and early 2000s moves to study transnational movements, to study other kinds of actors, which is, of course, not itself novel. There had been a wave of the stuff in the 70s and a wave of the stuff before them, but the latest wave of taking transnationalism seriously. So she's very much kind of in that that arena. However, when you privilege... There's a real risk when you privilege, when you try to are looking for women's agency or looking for anybody's agency, that you privilege certain kinds of actors, right, who are able to actually exercise power, and that you privilege certain kinds of actors who maybe are trying to change things in a direction that you think is more emancipatory. And there are times when you're reading the book, and this starts already in the section, where you're saying, well, are we talking about women as a category here? Are we talking about feminist activists as a category here? Now, in some of the substantive chapters, particularly in the kind of core chapters, the bananas, beaches, and bases chapters, I think she really deals with this problem effectively. And then in some of the later chapters, she really does focus on agency that isn't necessarily agency that's deployed in a way that is emancipatory for the people involved, right? Agency which is thwarted, or agency which maybe isn't oriented in what we would normally think of as a feminist direction. But it is an issue, right? And it's something worth thinking about.
I agree. And I think one of the things, and this is just to set up stuff that we're going to go through in some of the later chapters, she's sometimes unclear whether social arrangements always require some kind of deliberate agent at the core of those social arrangements to have set them up. So sometimes she'll say, yes, there needs to be somebody actually constituting these things, and then sometimes they appear to be much more unowned processes. So I think this is another way of me saying basically what you just said. There's a question here about exactly where agency is located and the dilemmas involved in locating agency in any particular place, which is characteristic not just of feminist IR, but is characteristic of a lot of social theory. And it will be interesting as we go through this to see how she tries to resolve that.
Although there are a number of times in which, I mean, this doesn't get at your concern, which comes out of whether or not we can go too far in privileging agency, mm-hmm. and whether that's necessary for a kind of both a denaturalization and a critical move. But she does really stress a lot of times there are authors, but what they're doing is not intended to produce the results that they produce. So there are, for example, when she talks about basing arrangements, and she talks about attempts to regulate who can marry whom, essentially, or who can have intercourse with whom, that are driven by a lot of different kinds of political and social attitudes. There are obviously conscious attempts to, say, make it more difficult for African-American U.S. soldiers to marry or engage sexually or romantically with white British women. But she does specify that the effects of these decisions reverberate down the political chain well beyond things that we think about as gender or race issues. And so it's when we say that this question of authorship, it should be clear that this is not necessarily people pulling the strings to do things to have the effects that they intend to have. Right. And I think it's just, I know this doesn't get your objection, but I think we need to be clear about this, that there are two separate issues. There's the question of agency that produces unintended consequences through processes of different agents acting and interacting in ways that then get you certain places that are not what anybody intended. And then there's the question about whether or not we really have to focus on agents at all. Now, in a particular feminist lens, you would have to focus on agents because part of the problem is the systematic denial of women as agents. And so part of the process of correcting for that would require you to stress women's agency and actorhood. And certainly at the time when this book comes out, this is an incredibly revelatory project just to do that. Even if maybe it raises some of the hackles of sort of a second or third order deep theoretical concern about what's at stake when you do this.
Right. And it's not just about the agency of women. If you look at page 12, since we're still in this chapter, asking how something has been made implies that it has been made by someone with a certain kind of power. Suddenly there are clues to trace. and this is the really key part of the sentence, there is blame, credit, and responsibility to apportion, not just at the start, but at each point along the way. And it's unclear, to me at least, exactly what that sentence means. Does that sentence mean that if we see an unequal set of power arrangements, that we always need to find some author who is behind them, who is putting them together so that we can apportion blame, credit, and responsibility? Or how much room is there in here for us to talk about unintended consequences, downstream effects, ways that things may not have been set up with this particular enforcement of gender roles in mind, but consequences of the actions reinforce certain kinds of gender roles? So, and I think, again, I don't think this is a resolvable question, but I think this is definitely something that animates a lot of the analysis.
Before we go on, I just want to say that if you haven't read this book or don't have a copy with you, it is also really cool because there are lots of visual illustrations and pictures that, and I think, you know, to me, it drives home how much you can illustrate and how many arguments you can make by talking about an image. So, for example, on the pages we're looking at, there's a picture of, you know, figure three is Mary Philips, a Scottish suffragette, selling the British suffragist newspaper, The Vote, in 1907. And of course, she is. This is a woman who is both exercising, disseminating knowledge. She's acting as an agent, but also there's something really interesting about this photo, which is that she is standing on the street, looking up at a man who is buying, presumably buying the paper from her, maybe arguing with her. It's not clear. He definitely has her hand in his hand. So, who knows?
And just one further thing on that point. The thing that I most remembered from this book, having not read it in total for a number of years, the thing I most remember from this book from when I first read it as an undergrad were the photos of the male world leaders with one woman in the picture. And the point that she drew from that, which is a point that really stuck with me over the years, that the presence of one woman in that kind of male environment shows how masculine the environment is. That her very presence calls attention to the context in ways that doesn't happen if you're simply looking at a picture and then you say, well, where are the women? Having a woman there sort of makes it readily apparent, similar to the way that having Barack Obama at meetings of the G8 or the G20 showed up exactly how white that whole organization is, just by his very presence of being there. So there's something similar that kind of, and I think that this is the point I'm agreeing with you on, Dan. There's something important about the visuality of that. So,
yeah, I think that I actually also found that point really cool. Even reading this as, you know, a late 40-year-old male who's lived through, I think, a lot of feminist theory and a lot of advances in feminist scholarship of international relations since this book was published. And so, while at times, you know, from my perspective, I felt like, you know, I knew this story, there's certainly times where I see, wow, you know, this is a really kind of powerful argument. And even if you think you know the story, it's still powerful to read and, you know, a really kind of profound statement of it. And it's also interesting because, of course, now with social media as a primary means of communication for academics and for politically active people, we spend a lot of time tweeting out pictures in which we call attention to the absence of women or minorities. I mean, for example, before ISA was canceled, Cambria Press had had sent around a kind of awesome authors, you should come to our booth, and all the authors were white men. I think they were all white, but they were all men, certainly. And this created a miniature firestorm. And what's interesting, given what we just talked about, was that Cambria, besides apologizing, then tweeted out, okay, well, here are all the awesome women authors. But it was all women.
Yeah.
And I think there's a case to me that in the sense they were reinforcing the entire exercise unintentionally by segmenting off women from men.
Absolutely. Well, I think of the wonderful Tumblr project that Sarah Sarma started a number of years ago. Congratulations, you have an all-male panel, right? Well, you don't want to win the Hoff Award. You don't want to have the nice picture of David Hasselhoff giving you a big thumbs up. And that has arguably had real effects on how conferences put panels together. And I think one of the most powerful things in that have been photographs that she's been able to circulate, and other people have contributed to this project, but she's the curator of it, of conference programs with all of the all-male panels highlighted. And you just look at the sheer number. There's something important about the visuality of that, just the sheer impact of how many panels we put together, or we used to put together, that were all male. And now I think that norm has shifted. People are kind of deeply skeptical of setting up a panel that's all male. And I think that's a really fascinating commentary on the kinds of things that have changed. And I think the visuality of it is tremendously important.
And lest you think this is all academic navel-gazing, keep in mind that if Enlo is right, academic conferences are important sites of international relations. And certainly something like the International Studies Association, which has over 50% of its membership derived from outside the United States, is an important international meeting site. In fact, that's part of the reason we canceled it. It's a great disease vector. So and that is part of the feminist sensibility, is that academic practice itself is, of course, a site of international politics. And that matters both because it is an important producer of knowledge, but also because it is a location for power relations. On to tourism,
yes,
which is chapter 2, Lady Travelers, Beauty Queens, Stewardesses, and Chambermaids, subtitled The International Gendered Politics of Tourism. So what did you think of this chapter?
So as a general summary, I think we could say that what she's trying to argue here in chapter 2 is that international tourism has always been wrapped up with various kinds of gendered practices, including depictions of destinations as feminized to be conquered by the masculinized traveler. The traveler themselves is understood as masculinized, and something like female stewardesses is a way of propping that up, right? You're there to be served. And then sex tourism, which she argues is not different than regular tourism. It's just, in a sense, the gender coding of it is even clearer than it is in some other kinds of tourism, that the international tourism in general has always been kind of shot through by these kinds of gendered practices. And I think as an empirical set of claims, I think she does an excellent job illustrating this, right? It's once you read this kind of an account, it's impossible to look at tourism ads or think about the practice of tourism in the same way. Particularly, I think of advertisements for travel to the Caribbean, and the ways that the entirety of the Caribbean is figured in U.S. tourism discourse as being this open-ended place of pure service, where you're going to go and be waited upon hand and foot. And that the calling attention to the gendering of that, I think, is empirically something that would be very hard to question, I think, after you read this account. So I think on an empirical level, it's incredibly compelling. Where I have more questions about it is in some of the theoretical components to the argument. So in particular, on page 75, there's a phrase that just jumped out at me. It says, the unhelpful passive tense that dilutes their political content. Which I find interesting. What is it about the passive tense that dilutes political content? Well, further down that page, each one of these sex tourism activities is done by someone. By whom? To study sex tourism calls for naming who does what at each step along the way. Sex tourism and all the men and women who make sex tourism possible continues to shape the economic, political, and cultural relationships between countries. In particular, taking the workings of sex tourism seriously shines a bright light on the ways that both masculinized sexual anxieties and efforts to assuage those anxieties shape relationships between countries today. The striking part for me is that the first two sentences. Why is it important to name who does what at each step along the way? Why is it important to identify particular individuals? So that was something that I found really, really striking. It's this importance again of apportioning blame. And I wonder to what extent one needs to do that in order to conduct the rest of the analysis.
Well, this gets back to your double movement, right? Because, or your double movement's wrong term, your sort of double edge, right? Because so one version of this is, we need to know that Joe Smith exploited young girls in Thailand, and he was able to do so because Brian Dawkins arranged the trip and set it up. The local police officer, this particular person, turned a blind eye and took the bribe so that the gray market sexual activity could take place, and that the girl was there in the first place because of something that happened in her village where, you know, X, Y, and Z did whatever. There's another version of this, right, which says we need to mark the roles, that is, the subject positions that are at stake. And to understand those subject positions and their relations to one another is to understand who holds the power in what particular exchange, and who holds the power in who being the subject positionality, the role, right? Not the specific individual who deserves to be locked up because they engaged in illegal bribery and illegal taking of a bribe. And so this is how we understand power relations. And that version of the argument has, I think, is broadly consonant with the way that you look at the world, right? In the way that I tend to look at the world, which is as put together by relations, processes, and positionalities. And so it's a way of, you could even think about it as mapping the network, as it were. In that version, I think you would be perfectly comfortable with, no?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I definitely would. It's the question of what exactly is the methodological or epistemic standing of the naming of particular individuals, or the identification of authors for actions. There are times when Enlow's analysis seems to be very concerned with figuring out who's to blame, and there are times when Enlow's analysis seems to be very concerned with examining the effects of particular kinds of arrangements. And again, clearly for her, these run together. I'm not so sure theoretically that they have to run together.
Sure, and this is why you invoked Hacking's sliding scale at the beginning.
Yes.
The question, and this is actually a question which is much broader than Enlow's book or feminist IR. It's a question that I think we are, you know, both of us are kind of liberal Democrats or left Democrats, whatever you call it, that we confront all the time. It's a question that conservatives confront a variety of all sorts of people. I mean, everybody confronts this problem, every political movement, which is, does politics require an other, right, an enemy, an author of what is bad that's happening? And even if that might be theoretically or ontologically suspect, it might be necessary for political action. And then more broadly, right, there's the question of causal attribution, right? If we are going to be able to say that some people have moral responsibilities of certain type, they have to also be authors of action, right? If they're not authors of anything about their action, then how do they have a moral, you know, what is their moral stake? What is their moral standing? And that then goes back to the politics. So, I mean, I we don't have an answer to that right now. I just, you know, I think it's worth underscoring. The thing that I wanted to make sure we called attention to here actually happens much earlier in the chapter, and it's the argument about who gets to travel, right? Or not who gets to travel, because throughout, there's a lot of historical work here, right? There's a lot of study of the evolution of tourism. And one of the key points is that tourism is initially gendered heavily male, not just in the sense that the touristic gaze is male, but that tourism is for men. And this is about reinforcing a whole set of gender dichotomies surrounding gender, one of which is the fear that if the woman travels, leaves the safety of the domestic setting. The domestic setting, I mean both the national domestic setting and the household domestic setting, that her virtue will be questioned. Right, you get this wonderful story about Thomas Cook,
yes,
who figures out, you know, through a letter he gets from, you know, he figures out, but not on his own at all, right, through the help of these two women, he can arrange temperance tourism that will ensure, because it's controlled, it will ensure that the women who go on it don't have their honor impugned. Right,
exactly.
That they aren't seen. There's no suspicion of them having gone out, gotten drunk, and had illicit sexual liaisons. This is sort of presented, I don't know if this is true, but it's presented as one of the key origin points. I mean, he starts these tours beforehand. There are male versions of these tours, but you can sort of see the direct line between this and the kind of very comfortable tourism where it's all prepackaged, the meals are arranged, the tourism where you don't have to eat the local meals, they can assure you that you will eat American food that you like, you know, that where you maintain that domestic and that domesticity abroad. Mm-hmm. And I think it actually, like, it's pretty kind of neat to sort of see the gender dynamics of that. I mean, did you have the kind of reaction?
Yeah, but what's also fascinating is the way she's very clear that even that kind of extended domesticity is a kind of liberation.
Yes,
that,
and this
the mobility of, even if it had to be done under the heading or the framework of keeping the domestic space safe by kind of moving the domestic space abroad, that there's still quite a lot of liberation in the very ability to go abroad without one's male lord.
Protector, companion, what have you. Mm-hmm. So this is, I think, the point I wanted to make, is that she, from, because she's telling this history where over time, that looks kind of Whiggish, right? If you look at the Western Europe and the United States, where over time women are increasingly emancipated to travel, she will problematize that later in various ways. But she tells this history, and one of the things she says at the outset, which I think is really powerful, is to say that the right to decide whether or not you get to travel, right? That is, the ability to be footloose, as she puts it, mm-hmm. you know, is a really crucial aspect of agency, because women are being transported all the time. Historically, they're being transported as slaves, as wives who are being chaperoned from point A to point B, or marriageable young women who are going to India to try to, you know, get a husband. And until you're, so that once, it's only once you are able to make the decision about whether or not be able to you're able to travel, and the decision about whether or not be able to travel, where it's not a decision forced upon you, everybody is starving to death in my home country, say, I don't know, Ireland, and so I have to go overseas, you get agency. And so there is a really important aspect of tourism which is caught up. It's not just a reflection of increasing agency of women, it's also productive of increasing agency of women. But on the flip side of that, tourism requires rendering where you're going exotic, attractive, seductive, exciting. So it's a form of, it requires both exoticization of where you're going, and it also requires a kind of aesthetic, which, as she shows, very easily empirically slides into an aesthetic of, we have beautiful women, come see our beautiful women, in the context of international beauty pageants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, the most amazing thing about this book is the way she's able to connect these seemingly disparate phenomena. And then you suddenly realize that, oh, wait, actually, this is the same. It's the same mechanism playing out in different kinds of empirical formats. I have to admit that I did a little bit of a double take just because of our current political situation when I got to page 60 and, you know, the sudden reminder that the Miss Universe pageant is owned by Donald Trump.
Yes, it's like, a business, billionaire businessman, Donald
billionaire,
Trump.
American billionaire Donald Trump. Whoa! But just showing the similarities in arrangement, the similarity in discourse, the similarity in practice that you have here between tourism, sex tourism, and beauty pageants. Right? There's a, once you, again, it's one of those things, once you see it, you can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. So she really affects a kind of interesting gestalt switch here, where mm-hmm. now we see that these things are of a piece, in that they are similar kinds of patterns, similar kinds of tropes being repeated in slightly different ways, but very, very similar kinds of gendering effects.
And we should stress, because I think we moved on to this point perhaps a little too quickly, that the other dimension of this is service.
Yes.
Right. A lot, not all tourism, but a broad variety of tourism is dependent upon the idea that you no longer have to engage in domestic household chores when you get there. So somebody else will clean your room. Somebody else will make your bed. Somebody else will serve you. And this has different valences if you are a woman coming from a gendered environment where you're responsible for household chores, and you're a man who has never had any responsibility for household chores. And I think that's a kind of interesting point. Mm. One thing I'll say before we move on is that she also has, I think, a very good answer for people who say, why is this international politics? The fact is that by definition, it's transnational international politics. These are people going across borders to spend money and to interact with foreign people. But also, it's big business. Right. So it's a really important part of international political economy. And for some countries, it is a very large percentage of their annual GDP is caught up in tourism.
Yeah. And where I buy her, mm-hmm. her repeated insistence on identifying individuals with motives and responsibilities is precisely on a point like that, mm-hmm. because then you have people who have a lot of financial interest wrapped up, particularly in being able to make your country friendly to or desirable as a tourist destination. And there are whole economies that are engineered this way, particularly post-colonial economies, where they needed to sell something. And so this became the thing that they were able to use to enter into the global marketplace. And it's interesting because when it comes to that kind of thing, I have absolutely no qualms about saying, yeah, there are people with interests who are promoting a certain kind of agenda. Sure. When we get to later chapters and she talks about, say, the policies about non-fraternization on bases, I think the question of motive and blame gets a little bit more ambiguous, but we can get to that.
There's one other point I want to make about this issue of it being international politics. Is last week we read Waltz, right? And while Waltz's argument is primarily about the great powers, it has been extended, perhaps inappropriately, to all states. And one of the key arguments there is that under anarchy, there's no specialization, right? You don't have a lawyer state. You don't have a police force state. Every state has to sort of make for itself. Now, this is really a point about great powers, and there it's a more effective point. But here we see specialization. There are countries that have constituted themselves as playing really one role in the international system, and that is as a tourist destination. So, A, I think this is an interesting place where kind of feminist argumentation starts to really undermine, not in terms of, oh, you're being patriarchal, et cetera, you know, and I don't want to sound like I'm mocking that. Obviously, we have incredibly important work by Ann Tickner, for example, that shows the genderization of, say, theory of international politics, but a way in which empirically, if you don't pay attention to something which is caught up in gender, or that maybe you don't have to get to tourism through feminism, but feminism helps take you to tourism, where you can see that certain claims about functional differentiation in international politics are just wrong. There is functional differentiation. And that functional differentiation literally means a different role in the international political economy.
And in particular, a gendered role in the international political economy. Right.
And in performance of any role is going to have a gendered element, even if we're in a non-patriarchal society. Mm-hmm. And this can take you all sorts of interesting places. So one of Anne's students, Laura Schoberg, who we all know and love well, and perhaps we can get on this at some point, has done work also, she's extended Anne's argument to hegemony, right? And shown hegemony as a sort of gendered construct. And one of the things I've always been interested in, and there's been an increasing amount of work on this, is how hegemonic ordering may be ordering not just in terms of rules and norms about free trade or military power understood in this very gender neutral way, but maybe ordering of international gender performances. Right here, we start to sort of see those things link up. Right, where if you have a certain kind of feminized gendered performance, which is necessary to constitute yourself as a tourist destination. That may be a way in which the international order, not the hegemon, but the international order itself is constituting a kind of gendered role structure where states themselves are gendered in certain kinds of ways. Right. So anyway, I just wanted to make sure I said that. Next chapter.
This is the nationalism chapter, nationalism and masculinity.
Yeah. Right?
So the national story is not over, and it's not a simple story.
Right.
So you want to try to summarize it, or?
Not really.
Okay. Because I have a real quick summary.
Yeah. Why don't you do that?
Right. So at least this is what I take away from it. Nationalism often venerates women as a possession of the nation, but doesn't accord actual women a place in shaping nationalist policy. Critiquing one's own nation is then grounds for dismissal. So you can't, you have to put your gender concerns to the side because of the importance of the nation, is the sort of political gesture that she's disclosing. Nationalism is therefore ambiguous for women, and looking at the women shows us that nationalism is also about the maintenance of internal homogeneity.
Right. She has a great line about that, where she talks about how, you know, if your nationalism for, say, a colonized state is about recapturing your pre-colonial culture and institutions, there's a problem there, which is your pre-colonial cultures and institutions may have been on face more patriarchal than Western imposition. This is, of course, an argument the neoconservatives make for why we should invade places and overthrow the regimes, because women are treated poorly. This was also an argument made by, as she points out, by James Mill and other colonial apologists for why civilizing mission, et cetera, et cetera. Anne Towns, by the way, has a great book and article about this, about how standards of civilization are always caught up in how you being an assumed male leader or male member of society or male elite, treats your women, your being a possessive. But Anne points out is that the way that you treat your woman changes radically. So it starts in the Victorian era. It's, are they properly closeted and insulated from politics? Are they domesticated? And are they safe in domestic tranquility? And then by the time where the United States is invading Iraq, it becomes, you know, do you prohibit your women from participation in public sphere? That's what makes you, in fact, not civilized. But her point is, it's always women. And this is a line of argument that, you know, I don't know, I don't want to make the claim that, you know, Anne read Enlow and was therefore, you know, decided to go write her book, but it's a line of argument that traces through Enlow and her what she brought to the table. Now, so she's very conscious of this kind of duality right here, and this kind of tension. And she points out that it actually makes life very difficult for women engaged in national liberation struggles and for women engaged in nationalist politics, particularly among, quote unquote, what we used to call new nations, that is, former colonial states.
No, I'm looking for a particular quotation that kind of comes up with this. So if I'm looking here at page 96, right, it is not women's past experiences, present realities, and strategies for the future that are made the basis of the dominant understandings of nationalism they are urged to support. Yet, as Algerian feminists have warned, it is risky for a woman to criticize a movement that claims to represent her own nation or a regime that exercises authority in the name of that nation. So there's a way that the appeal to the nation rhetorically can be used to stifle internal dissent at the same time as the point you were making before, that the external treatment of women by the nation becomes an object of political contestation internationally. So there's this Janus-facedness to the nation, that it's used to discipline internal dissent internally, particularly dissent by women, and then the way in which women are dealt with, for lack of a better word, becomes point that can be used to signal something internationally. So there's both of those things going on at the same time, which is not a great position to be in if you happen to be a woman in a post-colonial society which is exploring questions of nationalism. It's a hard space to occupy, and she's very clear about that in some of the stories she tells here.
And, you know, look, this is through the chapter, it's already been happening, where what really starts to ramp up is what we would now call intersectional analysis. And I think she's doing intersectionality before it's cool, right? Very clearly in this book. And that's not surprising if you look at her biography, things I didn't know before we read this book, which is that she started out as a race and ethnicity scholar. So this is the chapter, isn't it, where she talks about American women engaged in the civilizing mission. Perry Paxton, this woman who goes to the Philippines at Rio. So the United States conquers the Philippines, or the U.S. gets the Philippines as a part of its war settlement with Spain, right? So, and this is in 1898, where the United States takes on a formal colonial empire. The U.S. has always been an empire, right? The U.S. expansion westward is classic settler colonialism. But, and we talked about that last time, I think, but, you know, here is where the United States gets its formal empire, right? It gets its, it enters the European club. And so she talks about, you know, Paxton going over to the Philippines in sort of in search of adventure and doing good, and winds up being a school, sort of running the schools and helping to set up school teaching and being a school teacher, I presume herself, up in a rural village in the Philippines, where there's also a lot of guerrilla insurgent activity. And she makes the point that this is sort of liberatory for her. Right. And in some ways, she's also the things she's teaching, she's breaking, you know, the American style of education she's promoting is clearly more emancipatory with quotations around it than the Spanish version that she's displacing. But at the same time, she is an agent of white imperialism. And so this duality really comes out nicely. And this is why one of the things I wanted to point out, we're caveating, you know, this sort of not every story about the women gaining agency here is a story about doing unequivocally good feminist work, as it were. And I think this is a really powerful story there. There's also, I think we ought to talk about the Boy Scouts.
Yes. Yes. Oh, the Boy Scouts.
And Figure 12.
Figure 12, which I'll tell you. Now, I'm an Eagle Scout, so I was a Boy Scout all growing up. That figure is not in the current editions of the Boy Scout handbook.
We should describe this figure. So this figure is somebody who looks basically like a Nazi portrayal of an Aryan man, with just his trunks on, so you can see he's, by the standards of the time, muscular and fit and trim. Also looks like he's got a mustache, maybe one of those ridiculous curlicue mustaches, maybe, it's not clear. And he is a white man, and then there is also a man, it is called a white man and a man. And the man is clearly black, right? He's exaggerated Negroid, quote-unquote Negroid at the time, features. He's wearing a top hat, sort of shambolic clothing, right? Mismatched clothing. He's clearly shorter, right? Even with the top hat, he still is not of the stature of the Aryan man. And he's, weirdly enough, got his hand resting on his shoulder. I'm not quite sure what that's about. From Recovering to Success, a book of life sport for young men, which is by Robert Baden Powell, who is, of course, the founder, right, of the Boy Scouts. Is that correct?
Exactly. Exactly.
And the point is that the Boy Scouts are, of course, founded to give white European, of European descent, right, white men, to keep them away from drugs, venereal disease, and make sure they marry the right kind of white women. To groom them correctly to be carriers of racial purity and racial uprightness.
Right. Baden-Powell, this is on page 101. Baden-Powell and other British imperialists saw sportsmanship combined with respect for the respectable woman as the bedrock of British imperial success. I'll tell you, that's not what they tell you now in the Boy Scouts. But certainly the origins of this have to do precisely with, you know, performing this kind of masculinity, performing a certain, shoring up a certain kind of masculinity. And the nice thing about Enlow's analysis is that she points out, and this is when you get down to page 103, the surest way for a young man to find the right girl was to marry a girl guide. And girl guides, of course, is what grows up to become the Girl Scouts.
So, yeah, this is straight up Aryan youth shit, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it is, what's interesting to me is the dichotomous nature of it. To be a Boy Scout logically implies girls that the boy would then desire, and then the Girl Scouts become the desirable other that then shores up the masculinity of the Boy Scouts. So the whole thing is part of a complex, right? It's masculinity, femininity always occurring as a binary, and positive forms of that then being able to be differentiated with the negative forms. So you have sort of one thing, the role of the Boy Scout, which immediately turns into like a fourfold. So Boy Scout, Girl Guide, then black inferior person, according to that figure. And then I guess the alternative would be the woman who wasn't good enough to be a girl guide because she was somehow of loose morals or something like that. So there's an entire moral cosmology that's packaged into this. And the thing that's really interesting about feminist work is how well it does excavating that kind of conceptual architecture. So it's always there, even if it's implicit. And what the feminist curiosity does is haul it out into the open and sort of make you look at it, which is absolutely amazing contribution.
I should interrupt us here for a second to point out that the podcast that I ripped off, or that we ripped off, Game Study Study Buddies, has a episode on C.L.R. James's autobiography, which is very much focused on sport and cricket. And you know, what's interesting to us there, I think, is that ultimately a large number of people in formal British colonies become cricketers. They follow the sportsmanship model, and they beat the British at their own game, of course, which is an important kind of moment, I think, an important kind of dynamic in which this British imperial sportsmanship is then constitutive of national identity in reaction in a number of former British colonies and British colonies. So what is the point, though, of talking about the Boy Scouts? I mean, we need to make this clear, right? Besides the fact that it's, you know, yet again dredging up the really sickening roots of the Boy Scouts. I mean, look, yeah. Every institution we live with has sickening roots, right? I mean, it's right. A matter of acknowledging them and purging them and recreating the institution that matters.
Right, right. Right.
Letting the Boy Scouts be the Boy Scouts.
Right. I mean, I think the thing that's significant about this is a particularly good example of how a feminist curiosity about gender roles illuminates international politics as being something that is really woven into everyday life. That we don't tend to think about the Boy Scouts in the first instance as being international politics. But if Enlow's right, and I think she is, then it is international politics. This is international, or maybe international relations or international affairs, depending on, you know, however we want to define that. But you can't understand what's going on in something like the Boy Scouts unless you understand this kind of history that it's connected to. Mm. And thinking of those things as sites of political contestation, thinking of those as sites at which gender codes are being repeated and people are being constructed into and socialized into them. That these are, in a way, the practical moments in which international affairs is actually occurring. And this is then the infrastructure that makes possible a whole series of other things. So remember, this is still part of the chapter on nationalism. And so the argument here, I think, would be something like, we don't really understand what's going on in a nationalist movement unless we understand the important role that gender roles play in shoring up particular conceptions of the nation.
So there's also a update. The part of this chapter is clearly updated, right? And she talks about the Arab Spring and protests in Turkey. And the point she wants to make there, it comes out of the broader way in which you have traditionalism, pre-colonial traditionalism versus post-colonial and colonial, or at least colonial modernity, and the kind of difficult dynamics that creates, the dual nature of nationalism for women as both kind of a site of emancipation, but also potentially of exclusion and repression. And here I actually think that sometimes I do get a little, feel like the narrative gets a little bit carried away, right? So she discusses the protests in Tahrir Square, which of course we all know how those turned out, not that well at the end of the day. And she says, well, you know, in the fact that you had women who were wearing headscarves, right, protesting alongside women who weren't, that is women who represented the Erdogan, let's let women who show their faith in a more traditional way into universities, et cetera, next to women who are following the kind of Ataturk secularism model. This is an implicit repudiation of them both. And I mean, in a sense, yeah, it is. I mean, in a sense, you know, it shows that it's not an either or. But I wonder whether what work is being done by implicit there, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of those moments, I go back to that, the pictures of all male and then one female in the pictures of world leaders. There's a way that the image itself simply shows up how much work is being done about linking woman to tradition at moments like this. I don't think that's intended to be part of an explanation of why those protests did or did not succeed. I think it's more
Oh, no, no, I never said that.
No, 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 I hear you. But I'm trying to clarify, at least in my own mind, that this is, it's a much more interpretive point, right? Here's how we should read these things. And we should read this as showing us how much of the creation of the nation is about identifying and idealizing certain notions of femininity and tradition. So it shows up a number of things.
Right. And for those of you who maybe don't come from international relations or come from international relations recently, and so this is a little bit old news to you, in IR, right, if you go into the 90s and early 2000s, the predominant treatments of nationalism, there's none of this stuff. And so there, I think it's a really important, you know, it's a very important intervention to just sort of say, hey, look, there are gender politics that are not simply kind of an add-on. They're constitutive and inevitable and central in many ways to the kinds of politics that international relations scholars have long seen as important. In the same way, there's a movement here which is to call attention to what we would call intra-imperial politics as being international politics, which is important and is a early sort of a prefiguration of what I would say where the hierarchy studies work gets us, right? Which is to start thinking about breaking down the domestic international boundary in a particular way. And one of the sites for doing that is the ambiguity. I mean, Doyle points this out in the 80s, the ambiguity of whether or not relations between an imperial metropole and a periphery are international or domestic, right? They're neither, but they're both. So there's that going on here, but there's also ways in which nationalism is a core concern of international relations scholarship in this period, right? This is a period in which, in fact, if you went to grad school in the 90s, you would be taking seminars on nationalism. The same, I assume, in the late 80s, maybe?
I think so. And certainly, Enloe's own background, mm-hmm. a lot of her early work is right. in exactly this kind of stuff. And so this is a kind of feminist rereading of some of the material and some of the concerns mm-hmm. that she had in some of her first books.
Everyone, well, that's the end of part one. I'd be remiss in not noting that I absentmindedly and incorrectly referred to the Gezi Park protests in Turkey as the Tahrir Square protests, which were, of course, in Egypt. Anyway, our music is performed by Lyra Gemmel-Nexon. Thanks for listening. Part two should be up within a few days, and I hope that everyone stays as safe and healthy as possible.